Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Nicola Cairncross. Welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today, I'm joined by Steph, Teresa, Pat, Heather and Linda.
Hello! Hi.
This week on Write Club, Heather will be reading to us from her work in progress, after which we will offer her our comments, just as we do in our Write Club meetings. The theme this week is creating believable and memorable characters, so we're also going to talk about our most memorable characters through fiction. And we're going to hear what Teresa and Claire Hanscom are reading at the moment. But first, Steph is going to ask us to...
name the novel!
Okay, are you ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Here we go. I chose this because the heroine is quite a memorable character.
Okay.
It was first published in January 1908, written by a Canadian author. This is the first of 9 novels featuring this heroine.
Hmm.
The book was aimed at adults, but by the mid-20th century had become firmly established as a favourite book for children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pat and Teresa are looking very happy.
Easy for them.
You got it.
No,
me neither.
No.
Okay. Well, there are two possibilities, I think.
Okay. Right. Clue number 2. Then, we first meet the protagonist as an 11-year-old orphan. She's accidentally sent to work on a farm for a middle-aged brother and sister who had asked to be sent a boy.
Yep.
Right, so Pat and Teresa are looking even more smug.
Nicola
and Linda are looking...
seats are still...
Heather's frowning as if it might be on the tip of her tongue.
Right.
Okay. Our heroine is fanciful, imaginative, passionate, quick-witted and clever. But she loathes her appearance and in particular, her hair.
Mm. I've got a glimmer.
Mm. Try then, Nicola.
Anne of Green Gables.
Correct.
Oh, I was completely wrong. There you go.
Really?
Are you?
I was going down the Pollyanna route.
Oh, right.
I hate
it. I didn't realise Anne of Green Gables. I've read it. I didn't realise it was set in Canada.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Can we have the author, please, somebody?
Ellen Montgomery.
Absolutely.
Don't ask me what the Ellen stands for.
Lucy Maud. Lucy Maud Montgomery, but it was published as L.M. Montgomery.
All I could see was the hair.
Yeah.
Well, what is her hair like? Because
it's bright red.
Oh, okay.
And she had pale skin and freckles.
Yes.
And the only thing she liked about herself was her nose. And bless her heart. And but one of the reasons I really like her is that she was always very passionate and enthusiastic about everything.
Yeah.
And there's a lovely quote from the book, which I quite often paraphrase. But the actual quote is, "It's been my experience that you can nearly always enjoy things if you make your mind up firmly that you will."
Oh,
very good.
What a
and I think that's
quote.
a lovely way of looking at it.
Wonderful.
It is, and it's, I think it's very true, isn't it?
Yes.
When you go with a positive attitude, I mean, you know, you do get more out of it.
That's right.
Absolutely.
Everything is attitude.
Yeah, Anne of Green Gables. Now, I wasn't aware that it was the first of 9 novels because...
That's what threw me.
Yeah,
because I didn't realise it.
Following Anne of Green Gables, it's Anne of Avonlea, and it follows her right up until she's in her
40s.
Right. Wow. So we go with her throughout the 9 novels, and then there are 3 other novels after that which deal with her antecedents. So Lucy Montgomery wrote 12 books around.
A bit like the Little House series, which takes right through to after she's married and has a child.
A little like Little Women.
Exactly.
But only up to about 5 or 6.
And in fact, in Canada, there is a theme park which is, you know, got Avonlea and farm, and, you know, people go there. And there's a theme park in Japan as well, because in Japan, it's very much part of the national curriculum to teach Anne of Green Gables.
Really? Wow.
It's amazing. It's amazing. But I remember loving it as a child.
I did, yeah.
I'm Anne of Green Gables with red hair and freckles.
I love any feisty female protagonists.
Yeah.
There was a TV.
Yeah, there was.
Wasn't it?
Yeah,
which was
several,
actually quite well done.
Several TV adaptations and also films, I believe.
Yeah.
Very good. You got
very
me.
Good indeed. Thanks very much, Steph.
I got Teresa, yes.
Right, as I promised, we're going to now listen to Heather read from her current work in progress. Heather?
Thank you. I'm very sorry it's short, but it is the first try at a character in hopefully a larger work that I'm planning. I wish I didn't have to work in this godforsaken place. If I have to be pleasant to one more miserable customer, I'll scream. JJ stood in the doorway, fastening her apron. It's not so bad, JJ. Most of them are just plain lonely. This place is close to home, and with the tips, the pay's not too bad. Oh, Lou, you're just too good to be true. This one-horse town stinks, and as soon as I can, I'm headed right out of here. JJ snapped at her friend. Where would you go? Lou asked in mock horror. Liverpool, she responded triumphantly. Where in hell's name is that? Lou laughed. It's in England. A beautiful young man called Joe Gomez was in here last week. He was a professional soccer player, and he played for Liverpool and England. And he told me all about his wonderful city. He said that I would easily get a job there. Lou shook her head and smiled at her friend. She knew full well that JJ wasn't going anywhere fast. JJ put on her best smile and walked into the diner. Jessie walked into the dimly lit diner and sat on the usual stool in the corner. A glance in the mirror over the bar confirmed that this evening's preparations had been worth it. Hair freshly cut, smart and casual, the stylist had said. The suit may have cost an entire month's pay, but it was worth it. The subtle blue tones in the otherwise grey cloth looked expensive but not too flashy. The jacket hung well, a perfect fit. The pale blue handkerchief, a nice touch to match the beautifully pressed shirt. The pants fitted well, not too tight, and the razor-sharp crease as straight as a die. The shoes gleamed in the half-light, overall appearance good, ready to face the world. A nod to JJ and a large ice-cold beer appeared on the counter. No need for words, no place for pointless small talk. The others were all in their rightful places. Bill with his head in his hands, Pete tucking into his ribs and fried chicken, and Betsy at the bottom of maybe her third beer.
Mm. Oh, who are these people in the bar? Is this part of the series of things that you're doing for...
Yeah, it was my observation of people around a bar in Lafayette.
Yes, right.
So is this in America?
In Lafayette,
set in America.
Lafayette, Louisiana.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's quite clear actually from the names and
the diner.
Yeah. I think it's quite clear that it you know,
and pants rather than trousers.
Yeah.
I got that.
Yeah. Okay, I didn't.
I particularly like his shoes gleamed in the half light.
Yeah, that's nice. That's nice.
There was just when you went from the Jessie putting a smile on to walk into the diner, and then he walked into the diner. I thought there was a little bit of repetition.
I didn't
there.
Mention he,
didn't you?
No, Jessie. JJ. So
no, I'm assuming it's a he. Okay.
No, Jessie's a bloke.
Oh, right.
Right.
But the point Nicola was making is that you've got the end of. Paragraph, JJ put on her best smile and walked into the diner.
Right.
Jessie walked into the dimly lit diner immediately after. That was your writing point.
Doesn't really matter what sex anyone is at this stage in my dim brain.
But did, was, Jessie was not there before she went in then?
No.
Okay. She had been in there working for a little bit and then Jessie came in.
Yeah. Okay. This is I've not gone back through it. I wrote it, and so yes, there probably are things where I've not quite got it.
Yeah, but I think it's I love the opening. I think it's very economical. JJ stood in the doorway, fastening her apron. It tells you don't need to say she worked in the diner. Yeah.
No, she's already
said about working in this godforsaken place. And so I think it's strong.
Yeah, and I thought the opening was very strong. In fact, I would have started it. If I have to be pleasant to one more miserable customer, I'll scream, rather than even her saying, I wish I didn't have to work here. Because if I have to be pleasant to one more is telling us she's not happy.
Right.
And it's also telling us a lot about how she feels about the customers, how she feels about her job, how she, you know, her kind of outspoken personality. I thought it was a great show.
Right. I like the fact that JJ stood in the doorway fastening her apron because it adds a little, you know, it just adds a little personality to that standing in the doorway, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't think it just has to be that plain. I like the description of that.
Yes, strong image.
Made me visualize more.
The whole thing made me visualize the bar, really.
Yeah.
I loved it, but I felt slightly confused about, is this the same diner? Was Jessie... Until later on in the paragraph where it becomes clear that he's a regular and he knows her.
And
I wondered for a minute, is he the guy that had been chatting her up and claiming to be a professional
footballer. No, because he was Joe Gomez.
Gomez is a real footballer.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He really plays for Liverpool.
Oh, okay.
One thing I did think was worth commenting on is the speech tags. I think when you say JJ snapped at her friend, well, it's not really that snappy. And actually, we know... You don't need to say that she snapped. And then you've got Lou asked in mock horror. She responded triumphantly. They're a bit exaggerated responses, it seems to me.
Yeah, thanks for that. You know, thanks seriously, because at first I didn't have it. I just had the people speaking without any sort of, you know, mockingly, triumphantly, whatever. I didn't put that in. And I wondered whether people might get confused about who was speaking.
Well, I think you've got, oh, Lou, you're just too good to be true. So JJ that's speaking. Then the response, where would you go? So we know that's Lou. Yeah. Liverpool. So I think for a short piece, we do know.
It's I think it would work like that as well.
Because it's kind of question and answer, particularly.
I'll put them in afterwards. I think
you can do without many of them, and also you're giving us. I think you're giving too strong an emotion to each as
you
well.
You could use body language instead. So when she says Liverpool, she could sort of toss her head or do something that gives an exposition of being triumphant. You know, she's you thought you'd catch me out. I've got the answer.
In the United States, I don't think they talk about a beautiful young man. I think they'd say a handsome young man.
Right.
So that might be...
Or it might just be her personality. Yeah, I mean, I thought the bit where we've got the walked into the diner, that maybe Jesse could strut because he's got this style thing. Anyway, it's just a thought. Yeah. But you'll find an appropriate thing.
I love how you arrive in the middle of the action. I think you've got great exposition of JJ's impatience and ambition. So we've already got that.
Yeah.
When you come to him looking at himself in the mirror, I'm not sure that he'd be able to see in a dimly lit diner. And looking at a mirror over the bar, he'd probably only see himself from about chest height upwards. So he might have to look down to see his shoes gleaming and his trousers straight, because it kind of read that he was looking at himself in the mirror, but that's such a minor detail. And I like the nod to JJ. No need for words, no place for pointless small talk. Like that's a good exposition of his attitude.
Right. And really nicely expressed.
Yes, lovely. And I really felt with the others are all in their rightful places. I really felt a sense that something was about to happen. So the scene is set quite well for me because I'm thinking, they're all in their rightful places. So what's about to happen?
We've got this routine at the same people come in every day, which is kind of what's driving JJ mad. You know, everybody's happy in their little rut apart from her. So it shows that very nicely.
I would like to say that about looking in the mirror, I don't think that's necessarily a problem that he can only see part of himself, because he knows what's down there and he knows everything he's wearing and how good it looks. He's looking at his head in the mirror and thinking he's very dapper, but he knows all the other stuff. So he's feeling like, I've got it all.
I just felt it was a bit of an info dump. We were getting a kind of list, whereas I felt it was a bit sort of a dump of information about how he was looking, and I think it would have felt more comfortable if he looked at himself and admired his hair and then looked down at his... Because I can kind of imagine him. He's quite vain, isn't he?
He'd be giving
a bit of this. Straightening the line in his trousers. So I can see him doing all that.
And maybe Lou or JJ would say, ooh, looking good, or whatever, sharp suit or something. You can get... There's another way of bringing that in. I don't know. Yeah. I think it's okay as it is.
I'm just really looking at opportunities to...
But I just wasn't sure whose view is it. Is it JJ's or is it the narrator's? Is it his own description of himself? And I think you kind of get that it is, because you get the impression that he is like looking approvingly at himself.
And he says, ready to face the world. You know, that's his thought process.
Or is it the narrator's voice coming in?
With an American overall appearance, sounds a bit, you know, whereas the looking good brother
plan is to talk to Linda at some stage.
I think in terms of what you're setting out to achieve, you've done a great job here, and
I think it's a really good opening start.
It sounds really different.
to your other stuff.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So, yeah. Yeah. It's just amazing, yeah, the inspiration.
You want a spoiler?
No,
yeah. Yeah.
No, yes, no.
Yes. Yeah.
She's a woman.
Okay.
It's a
brilliant.
Yeah, you're not meant
that
to.
That is brilliant.
Yeah. Then maybe we need to leave the stuff in because all those details.
Oh, it all needs to be there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it definitely needs to be there.
Okay, you were just concerned about the.
I'm just rather than it being an information dump, it actually being woven into the narrative.
I think it's okay. I did pick up on one thing technically. You say the pants fitted well, not too tight, and the razor sharp crease as straight as a die.
Doesn't do anything.
It doesn't need a verb.
Yeah.
The razor sharp crease, oh, what? There's a verb lacking in that.
Okay.
And then while I was thinking about that, I thought, straight as a die? What is a die? And
that's
maybe
what I
you could think of an analogy of something that we would recognise as being straight. Rather, I mean, I do know what a die is, but it's a bit of a.
I don't.
It's an English expression.
Yes, I did think, and again, that's why I was going to talk to
our resident American consultant.
Yes.
Yeah.
And do the pants fit well, or the pants fitted well? Because that always confuses me, because American people say, oh, the pants fit well.
Right.
It wouldn't even be when they're talking in the
past tense.
Past tense.
Yeah.
Right.
They fit well. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
I will. Consult the Oracle.
Yes.
Yeah.
Great.
I think it's brilliant.
Good.
Thank
There's
you.
My
notes.
It.
Thank you.
Can't wait to see where it's going.
Yeah, really enjoyed that.
Okay, good stuff, everyone. We're going over now to Pat, who I think is going to enlighten us on a point of creative writing.
Well, no.
Oh.
Punctuation.
Oh.
Hyphen. This goes back to something that Steph said a while ago. I think we were talking about flash fiction and numbers of words, and I remember you saying something about perhaps we could talk about hyphens, because that's quite a handy way of reducing your word count. So it was lodged in the back of my brain somewhere. Fascinating subject, you know. Absolutely fascinating. I learnt all sorts. Whether I'll retain much of it, I don't know.
Mm.
And there's far too much nitty-gritty in a way, but I can give you an overall sort of flavour of when and why and how to use a hyphen. They're not used as frequently these days as they used to be. They're far less common than they
were.
Whenever
I put my stuff through Grammarly, it throws up loads of things needing hyphens.
Oh, must be just the way you
write.
Right, yeah. Okay. But there are three main reasons for using a hyphen. One is in compound words, and we'll come to that in more detail in a minute.
Mother-in-law?
Yeah.
Mm.
To join prefixes to other words, but only in certain cases.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what a prefix is.
Something that goes in front of something.
Like, correct.
Like
it's a little
pre or con or
one of those little things that goes in front to change the meaning. And also to show word breaks, but that's when you're sort of writing something out, or typing,
mm-hmm,
and you get to the end of a line. And to show that the word is going to carry on, you use a little hyphen. I'm not going to go into that.
Because that really virtually doesn't exist. Doesn't exist anymore with good word processors.
No.
I thought of a good example. Pre-drinks. What?
Pre-drinks. Pre-drinks.
Yeah. I'll start with the compound words. And basically, you're looking at compound nouns, compound verbs, and compound adjectives.
Mm.
And actually, compound nouns, which is one consisting of two component nouns. So air, crew, play, group, chat, room. You can actually present those any of three ways, either as one word, as two separate words, or hyphenated. Mm-hmm. And it's entirely up to you, the way you do it.
Is there not a progression? You know, when something is a new coinage, like air, crew, it might be air hyphen crew, and then gradually it becomes one word.
I don't know.
Well, I've noticed when I was a child, it used to be aeroplane, A-E-R-O-P-L-A-N-E.
It still is.
Now it's airplane.
No, that's American. In English, it's still aeroplane.
Well,
aeroplane, but it's one word.
Yes, aeroplane. It's one word.
Oh, yeah.
It's another case where you guys just waste letters.
And we like having A and E because that's unusual.
I mean, the tendency now apparently is to write them as one word or two separate words and forget the hyphenated version. But the most important thing there is to be consistent. So if you're writing about play groups, for instance, stick, whatever you decide on, stick with it. Don't start chopping and changing as you're writing.
Sometimes you do that, though, because you think, well, at least I'll be right some of the time.
No, it doesn't work like that. No.
And if you're writing long fiction, you want, and you're fighting a word count, you'd be having two separate words all the time. But yeah. If you're writing short fiction, you'd be having one.
Yes. That's a good point, yes, actually.
Yeah. Compound verbs. Use a hyphen when a compound formed from two nouns is made into a verb. For example, we talk about an ice skate. Ice and skate are two separate words. But to ice skate is hyphenated.
Right.
Ah, oh, so if it becomes a verb.
A booby trap
is two words, but
to booby trap.
If you're using it as a verb.
That's interesting.
A spot check, two separate words. To spot check is hyphenated.
Right.
It's a verb. Okay.
Right.
But you should
damn it. It's always an exception.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, but you should not put a hyphen within phrasal verbs, which are verbs made up of a main verb and an adverb or preposition. For instance, build up, break in, stop off. Right? So you've got break,
okay,
and in, stop, and off. So there, they broke in by forcing a lock on the door. We stopped off in Hawaii on the way home. No hyphens.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
However, if you change your verb, the verb into a noun, similar to the example I gave you before, you should use a hyphen. So there was a build-up of traffic. It makes sense to hyphenate build-up.
Yeah. A build-up rather than to build-up.
Yeah, right. A build-up.
Oh, God. So sometimes it's a verb that needs to be a hyphen and sometimes it's the noun.
The break-in. The house was unoccupied at the time of the break-in. You're making one noun, aren't you?
Yes.
Of breaking.
Yes.
So you hyphenate it.
Right.
God.
It gets even more complex.
Oh, good.
Stop
She'll
off.
Be testing us later.
No, I won't. So stop off. We knew there would be a stop off in Singapore for refueling.
Mm-hmm.
Is, again, one word. Mm-hmm. Well, hyphenated.
We've made it into a noun by calling it a rather than two stop off.
Yeah.
So with an at or a the in front of it, then it's hyphenated.
Okay.
Right.
I'll put you out of your misery in a minute. Compound adjectives.
Now, this is the bit that I get confused. Like, well-known, sometimes it's hyphenated, sometimes it's not. And that's the thing that I was interested in.
Yeah. Right, compound adjectives can be made up of a noun and an adjective, like accident, prone, sugar, free. Mm-hmm. Right? So, accident, noun, prone, adjective. Sugar, noun, free, adjective. Can be a noun and a participle, like custom-built, computer-aided. Or it can be an adjective and a participle, like good-looking, fair-haired, quick-thinking. All those are hyphenated.
Oh, right.
Those are good. If you form a compound adjective from the adverb well and a participle, like well-known, or from a phrase, like up-to-date, you should use a hyphen when the compound comes before the noun. So a well-known brand of coffee is hyphenated. Mm-hmm. An up-to-date account is hyphenated.
A good
right, but
a
if good you say
man.
Young man.
If you say this actor is very well-known in the north of England, it's
you
not.
You don't hyphenate it.
Because it's after the noun.
Yeah.
However,
yeah,
if he was well-endowed,
yeah,
he would be hyphenated.
If what?
If he was well endowed, it would be hyphenated.
Oh.
No, not after the noun. No?
No.
I don't know.
Well, does Grammarly know all of the stuff that you're saying?
I don't know. If you use it before, then it's doing the function of an adverb, of an adjective.
Yes.
If you're using it after the verb,
you're saying he was known and well
and
intensifies.
You're intensifying.
Right.
Yes.
The adjective with the well, adverb well.
Whereas when you're saying the well-known actor, it's actually almost an epithet, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you would hyphenate too,
So you just have to think
the
about the
use. Sea.
I mean, the main thing to do is to keep a dictionary by your side.
Absolutely.
To be consistent. If you're in doubt, just check.
Exactly.
And the main thing, like with any punctuation, is to avoid confusion.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, a couple of examples there. Springfield has little town charm.
Ah. Huh. Yes, it's ambiguous without
Without hyphens. Mm.
It's saying it has
very little,
little town charm. Well, yeah, town charm. Yeah, right,
because if you hyphenate little town,
yeah. But if you mean that it's
charming,
it's got the charm of a little town. Then little town is hyphenated. Mm. She had a concealed weapons permit. So she had. Did she have a permit concealed about her person?
Yeah.
Or did she have a permit for concealed weapons?
Weapons. Mm. And examples.
Yeah. Okay, so I also said that hyphens can be used to join prefixes to other words. And I think in the past that used to be the sort of the style. But again, that's changed. And very often now they run together as one word. But if the prefix ends in a vowel and the other word also begins with a vowel, like co-own, C-O, yeah, hyphen, then it's more usual to use a hyphen again. Otherwise, people, when reading, would
you don't know how to pronounce it.
I've always wondered about skiing.
Yes, how that gets away with the double I. How that
gets away, yeah.
No, you see, I think that
it probably used to be hyphenated, well, I would have thought.
But it was still to me.
It's not.
No, it's not.
It's a
verb.
A verb. It's not a prefix. It's just an ending, isn't it? But yeah, if you think prearrange or cooperate, you know, you've got co-own, you'd use a hyphen.
Cooperate
is accepted as not needing a hyphen. Yeah. You use a hyphen to separate a prefix from a name or from a date. So post-Tudor, right? Pre-1900.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would use a hyphen. And you'd also need one to use one to avoid confusion with another word. So re, if you think recover, do you mean recover?
Oh, okay.
Or do you mean upholster? I'm going to recover the suite.
Right.
See, I'd change it to reupholster.
You still need a hyphen.
Yeah, because of the vowel thing.
Yeah.
So
please, can I have those notes, Pat?
I will send them to you.
Thank you.
And then finally, you have to hyphenate all words beginning with the prefixes self, ex, meaning former, and all. So self-assured, ex-husband, all-knowing, all need hyphens.
Great.
So, as I say, there's a lot to learn. I'm indebted to, I think, the Oxford Dictionary or one of their sites. It's all on there.
Right, so we can go and look it up if
but
we
I think
need
the like you say, the answer is look it up every time. And I freely admit, when I started doing my degree, I didn't know how to use apostrophes. And every time I was writing an essay, I had the grammar book beside me, went to the apostrophes page, and I did that every single time where I wasn't sure, does this word until it sinks in? And that's how you learn.
Right. I would like to suggest that we put a small quiz for our friends on our Facebook group so that we can say, let's put about 10 of those online and see who can get them right.
Well, we'll volunteer, Linda.
Good idea.
Do feel free. Hi, everybody. Thank you very much, Pat.
You're welcome.
So what I'd like to do now is talk about what makes characters believable and memorable. And I think it's two different conversations. One's about writing our characters and how we can make them believable. And then we're going to go on to talk about some of your most memorable characters that you remember through the years of reading. Because I was astonished at how certain characters jumped out at me from my reading in the past. So I was thinking about what makes a character believable for me. And we can talk about each of your characteristics. Mm-hmm. For me, it is, there's the obvious archetypes. There's the hero archetype, who I feel particularly drawn to. But I also like anti-heroes or reluctant heroes. I find them really interesting as well. I've got some examples. So the hero types are the Jack Reachers, many detectives and private eyes, Jack Randall in Spares, Sarah Linden in The Killing, and Stephen Holder. I found him a particularly compelling character, who's the sidekick of the girl in The Killing. And then you've got your anti-heroes, reluctant heroes. Girl with a Dragon Tattoo is a fantastic example. Hunchback of Notre Dame. You know, he's an ugly hero who is a reluctant hero, and then he turns into, he's not an anti-hero, becomes a hero. Wallander, Thomas Covenant. We both like the Thomas Covenant books. And then you've got your villains and your physically repulsives. And one of the examples is Steerpike in Gormenghast. We're going to talk a bit more about later on. But what about you guys? What do you think makes a characteristic for me would be brave, flawed, loners, obsessives, addictions, struggling to overcome their past? So someone with a secret characteristic or a secret past they're struggling to overcome.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut says every character should want something, even if it's only a glass of water. I think really it's about knowing your characters, isn't it? Which I think is where the character sketch... I know Heather uses Proust questionnaire. You actually interview your characters, yes, don't you?
Yeah.
So that you as the writer know every facet of them, and then that will influence their dialogue, their actions.
I don't do those kind of questionnaire things. Maybe I should. I'm not saying that. But I think if you believe in the character and you understand their motivations, then hopefully that comes through in your writing. But I think when you're talking about archetypes, Nicola, and then actually you're talking about the individuals within that large group that stand out for you, what you're talking about possibly is where they differ from the archetype. I think for me, complexity of character is what appeals and what you want to achieve in your writing. You don't want your hero or heroine to be bland, good looking. I mean, there's a market for that. You know, there's a market for fiction where characters are idealized or perfectly good or perfectly bad. But it tends to be a kind of a superficial read. And whereas I don't claim to be writing great literature, I want to write something that's a bit more complex and engaging. And for me, especially with the Ranella story, I really want an emotional engagement from my readers, and I'm trying to bring her emotional life to the page. That's what I'm hoping to achieve, and that she's not like anybody else, she's herself.
And I think the flaws, and that, you know, that she's maybe slightly disobedient or willful or whatever, those are the kind of things that endear us to her.
And also that as a child reader, I hope you identify with, because we all get in trouble and do the wrong thing and mean well. And when we come to talk about favourite literary characters, I'll talk about Maggie Tulliver, because it's that thing of like getting it wrong.
So how do you all approach writing a character?
Heather uses the Proust questionnaire, don't you?
Some of the questions are, you know, things about, you know, sort of early childhood and, you know, sort of games at school. And certainly when I think about my first character, I wanted him to not have been picked at school for team sports and things like that. So he was always a loner. So I actually wrote it into his character that, you know, he was always alone. He was always a bit different. And hopefully that comes out.
So you knew that he was never picked for games at school, but you didn't need to share that with your reader. No. But that influenced how you made him behave and react. So that's really about having a good backstory that's known to you but not to anybody else.
And I think that's about the characters have to be sort of real, believable. And that's one way of doing it. With some of mine, I've done not the whole detail Browse questionnaire, but I have done backstory and where they've come from and what they've done, particularly Mark's story, him and the other characters in there. So I knew who these people were, and that puts flesh on the bones.
I think with your writing, it really is well observed. It comes from observing, and maybe that's a little bit of the actor in you as well, in your theatre experience of observing how people dress, move, speak, and I think that comes through in and the characters feel very real because of that.
And so the last couple I've done, I don't think I've actually done that, but I knew who those people were in my head for various reasons.
And I've always, you know, when people have flaws and inconsistencies, I always like to explain them to myself.
Yeah.
So, for example, Grace's mother isn't terribly kind to her. But the reason is that she's terrified her husband's going to leave her, because actually he's not her husband. They're not married. She's got a load of bastard children. She's scared. So she does give all her attention to him to the detriment of her relationship with her children. So there's a reason for her bad behaviour, if you like. If there's a nurse that's not behaving well, I will know the reason for that nurse's bad behaviour because I suppose it comes from me believing that nobody goes out saying, I'm going to be as horrible as I can today. And when people upset one another, it's never intentional. It's, you know, and that's, and I just feel that I want people to understand that even when people are not behaving, you know, even when people are being bad and baddies, there's a reason for that. Something's happened. They're coming from themselves.
Yeah. You want to be fair to all your characters.
I do.
That's very characteristic of you.
Well, it is, yeah. But, you know, like, you know, when I'm right, it would be very easy to put a Nurse Ratchet into my work about living in a mental hospital. Mm. And, you know, Nurse Ratchet was a very memorable character. But for me, that made her a bit of a caricature and a bit of a parody.
I think it's also a bit sexist, and you're thinking about it now from
it's a cultural stereotype.
It is. Mm-hmm. It is.
You know,
who was Nurse Ratchet?
In One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah, you know, the nurse who
medication time, and she really doesn't like. Mm. And also, you know, the character that was played by Jack Nicholson, he was also flawed, but I think he was given a much more sympathetic hearing by the author for whatever reason. But, you know, I think all of the things that you've described give each character a sort of distinct voice and personality. And that's the other thing I tried to do, is think about verbal tics.
Yeah.
So, like, Sister Burton occasionally drops a bit of Latin into her language. Mm-hmm. And that's because her father was a doctor and her brother was a doctor. And she really wanted to be a doctor, but girls aren't doctors, girls are nurses. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and she was bright enough to be a doctor. So I never share that with my reader, but I know that everything that motivates her is about being the girl and having to be subservient to the men in her family.
Right.
Silly thing, but I think it helps.
Well, when I'm working with Mary Magdalene, speaking of verbal tics, in the beginning, I had her, she's always thinking about, you know, when Eli is annoying or upsetting her, she'll think, he's getting all over my nerves. And she would say that occasionally, like a verbal tic. But I thought, maybe not. So I've taken it out.
You can overdo that sort of thing.
What I want the reader to feel is that Mary Magdalene wants something so badly. Mm-hmm. And it's a warped kind of way, or a warped kind of goal. Mm-hmm. But she believes in her childlike way that this is going to be the solution to her problem. Mm-hmm. And basically she wants to get out of a really poverty-stricken and even poverty-stricken education that she's receiving, and she's smart enough to know that there's more in the world. And so she wants that. I don't think her end goal at this point is going to work out, but she thinks Little Rock is glamorous and sophisticated and will have a great education system. She can live with her glamorous aunt, but she will learn later.
And that's important, isn't it? That your character goes on a journey and something changes. But I learn something or change an attitude.
I was hoping to have the reader sympathize with her because she's striving so hard to get there and to meet this goal.
Yeah.
Which may not have been chosen wisely, but she wants. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I'm hoping. And she's very, I think she's remarkable in that she's very smart and just says wonderful things.
She's got great wit.
And I think you're am I right in thinking you're drawing a lot on memory of childhood, and you're very in touch with your childhood as you write it?
I am, because I lived in the backwoods in that time, and my father was a preacher. However, we didn't go on a road trip. My mother was living. I was not like Mary Magdalene. I was afraid to hold my head up, had no confidence, very shy and very uncertain. And Mary Magdalene is like my alter ego.
You'd been.
She's everything.
Well, I want to be Mary Magdalene.
I'm always drawn to characters who are brave, because I wasn't a particularly brave child. So I would read about people who were brave and who did things that I would never do, I sort of hero worshipped them a little bit. So that was another characteristic. So characteristics that I aspired to made characters stand out for me as well.
What is it with Brienne that you're trying to do?
Well, I think that's why I'm struggling a bit with her at the moment, because I wanted to make her an anti-hero, a Thomas Covenant reluctant believer kind of person. But I think I'm struggling because her character is not full enough or complex enough or brave. I don't know is the answer. Perhaps I need to go and write about her. I don't know.
Yeah. You have to know. And yes, they might do things that surprise you sometimes. Yeah. But it that has to grow out of the truth.
Yeah.
Yes, and maybe you're trying to make her something that she isn't. So you want her to be this reluctant hero, but the material isn't there. And maybe if you just do some exercises to explore her character and personality, you'll find out she's something else.
Yeah.
More interesting, perhaps.
Have you tried doing the questionnaire?
I think I did at the beginning, but I might need to do it again.
Right.
I think the issue I'm having is that she's accepting what's happening to her very easily.
Yes.
She's not as freaked out as she should be by, you know, she's landed in this afterlife and she's going through these motions, but she doesn't seem to be railing against them or freaked out by them.
No, and she's delivering babies and things that she never expected to do.
There's not enough turmoil in her, I think there needs to be more turmoil.
Yeah, maybe.
What about things like physical characteristics? So we talked about Anne of Green Gables earlier with her red hair. Are you drawn to people who look like you or who you aspire to look like?
No.
Does it matter to you?
No, but I think with Anne of Green Gables, the red hair is a number of things. One is in that period, Irish settlers in Canada and in America were sort of quite striking with their red hair, and that may have, and in the UK, in fact, Irish people coming over in the early 1900s, and that red hair was a symbol of certain types of behaviour. It's a bit of a stereotype. So I can understand why striking red hair.
Yeah, it's the wild Irish, hooligans.
And if you remember, with Anne of Green Gables, her backstory was that she'd been used as basically a babysitter by other families because she was an orphan, and she was kind of fostered out with other families where she was left to look after the small children and beaten if she did anything or made any kind of mistakes. So she's had quite a sad story. And, of course, when she gets to Green Gables, she just longs to be Anne of Green Gables. Mm-hmm. She longs for Mariella and the brother. I'm sorry, I can't remember the brother's name.
I can't think of his name.
Mariella and her brother have got her there. And they'd wanted a boy, and Anne's saying, please keep me because I love this place. Mm. And the juxtaposition of Anne's extreme... She's a bit of a drama queen, isn't she? You know, she's always having these wild imaginings and going off at a tangent. Whereas Mariella... is a very staid, middle-aged, sensible woman. But the two of them, Mariella kind of becomes softer at the edges over the course of the first book. Mariella becomes softer at the edges and kind of learns, and the brother as well, and they learn to sort of accept the slightly wild ways of the little girl. And she matures and starts to appreciate that it's not all about, because she hates her hair and her freckles and her skin. The only thing she likes about herself is her nose, and she has to learn that looks and and things are not what it's all about. And the thing that appeals to me about her is not so much what she looks like. I think the red hair is a metaphor, if you like, for not fitting in with the world and for being different and for being judged, no, a book being judged by its cover, you know, red-haired orphan with freckles, you know, how awful.
Yeah, we often say in the South, oh, Lord, he's treating her like a red-headed stepchild.
Well, there you go. There's an expression. Really? Yeah. That's amazing. Oh, that's amazing.
What about but you guys? Are you drawn to appearances or repulsed by appearances, indeed?
No.
I have. Do you mean in reading?
Yeah, when, you know, for example, I was always quite drawn in a rather sick way to really disgusting characters. So there was Baron Vladimir Harkonnen in Dune, and he was absolutely physically repulsive, and I was quite intrigued by that. And again, you know, Steerpike and various other people. I'm thinking particularly of my childhood, because obviously that was when I was most impressionable. So when a character was physically repulsive, I was quite intrigued by them.
Everybody's looking at you.
Just you, Nicola.
It's just you.
No, it's interesting, isn't it?
I have a woman in a different work that I've worked on through the years who is a huge woman. She's maybe 6'2" tall, and she's just big boned and broadly built. And she's now in this housing project in Alabama. And she looks totally scary when somebody sees her. You know, she just looks really, because she's, you know, kind of stringy brown hair and straight down graying. And She's just formidable, and I wanted her to look formidable. I wanted people to react to her when they first see her in that way. Like, oh my Lord, you know, you
Jaws in James Bond.
Yeah, but it turns out she's one of the kindest people you'll ever want to meet, and she looks after children with such love and stuff. And so I really like her a lot. Yeah. I mean, I created her,
that,
but she's,
that often
I
works,
love
that kind of flipping the expectations. Yeah. So like the punk rocker who likes decorating cupcakes.
You've got a few in your stories, haven't you? You've got some punk, ex-punk rockers.
Yes, with piercings Mohican and all of that sort of thing.
But the character you mentioned reminds me of Mrs. Rag in No Name by Wilkie Collins. So Captain Rag is a fantastic character. He's a confidence trickster who changes his name and his identity from town to town, but he helps the heroine Magdalene along the way. They go into theatre together and he trains her as an actress and so on, but he's a brilliant character. But his wife is very large but not very bright, but very, very kind. But she's a very memorable character. He keeps her locked up because she's not very good at learning her new character when they go into new towns. He has to hide her away a lot of the time and pretend she's an invalid because she just blurts things out. Yeah. But those two, Captain Rag and Mrs. Rag, are fabulous characters. And, of course, Wilkie Collins writes fabulous characters anyway. But
Murdy, this character, is very wise. She's traveled the world because she was with the circus for most of her life, in the background doing sewing, mending, etc. She's very world-wise and very bright. And I kind of wanted her to have everything except the good looks. And I wanted her to be formidable, as I say. Yeah. So bless her heart. There's no redeeming features physically for Murdy, but she's everything else, kind, generous, wise, perceptive. She can see when things are...
It's coming through, I think, that stuff that's written for children is obviously written to teach them things, isn't it? You know, the stories are created to teach children how the world works.
Right.
And, you know, not necessarily every ugly person's evil kind of thing.
Right.
So,
Anne of Green Gables wasn't written for children. It was written for adults.
Wow.
And it became loved by children, but it was actually aimed at adults, and the other eight books are all very much adult books. So
she had a crossover hit.
Yes, I think she did. I think she did.
So we started to talk then about characters that have... Teresa just mentioned some characters that stood out for her. So who else, Teresa?
Well, I mentioned Maggie Tulliver from The Mill on the Floss by George Eliot, and also by George Eliot, Dorothea in Middlemarch. But Maggie Tulliver especially, because she is this very clever girl in a family who think education is just for boys. So she's a frustrated character, and she takes out her frustrations on her doll that she mutilates savagely. And she does have a temper, and she idolises her brother. And when her brother's away at school, she's supposed to look after his rabbits, and she forgets. And when he comes back, all the rabbits are dead, and then he falls out with her. And so she has these, you know, then she's desperately upset because her brother rejected her. So she has this very emotional journey. And obviously we go on into her adulthood, and if you haven't read The Mill on the Floss, it's tragic, you will weep. but a brilliant character that stays with me. That I think many women, I'm not sure if it's the same for men, will identify with, this sort of misunderstood girl child who wants to go to school, wants to learn, a bit like Mary Magdalene. I've mentioned before when we talk about Mary Magdalene, there's a bit of Maggie Tulliver about her. So that's one. And
it's a bit of an archetype, really, isn't it?
Yes.
That character.
Yes, but there's nothing wrong with archetypes if you reinvest them and make them real.
Yeah, right. I think that's absolutely right.
And the other one, completely different, that sticks with me, is Nucky Thompson from Boardwalk Empire. I don't know how many of you watch Boardwalk Empire. Brilliant television. But Nucky Thompson is a corrupt politician, a criminal. He has this criminal empire, but he also has this world-weary character. So he's involved with a showgirl who is very demanding and petulant, and he's kind of has this world-weary attitude to her. But then we also see his kindness to the important female character in the series, Margaret, who, when he meets her, is a poor Irish immigrant with an alcoholic husband who beats her. And he takes care of her. He takes care of her children. So we see this complexity. It's not just a villain. He's not, and he doesn't come across as villainous. And he has this interesting relationship with his German butler or valet as well, which shows another side to him. And one of the things you realise as you watch it, he appears to have no ethnic prejudices and things like that, which were prevalent at the time and other characters exhibit. So he's a really complex and interesting character. And there are some very funny moments. And he has this relationship with the young man, Jimmy, who is a very troubled young man. And they have a sort of father-son relationship, although they're not related. So it's all, you know, it's that complexity, I think, that makes him interesting and memorable to me.
I think that's probably, the word complexity is probably what made Eleanor Oliphant such a hit.
Because
when you look at her, she's socially inept, completely lacking in empathy. So she completely misreads other people's reactions. And I love the scene where she goes into the doctor's and tells, and she's saying things like, he was doing that thing where he taps away at the keys. And then she says, I've got backache and I know what's causing it. And he says, what? She says, my breasts, because I've weighed them and they're very heavy. And then he clears his throat. And you can see what the doctor is thinking. Oh, my goodness, what have I got here? And she is completely unaware of it. And some of the scenes are quite hysterically funny, you know, like when she goes to the beauty parlor and doesn't know what she's asking for.
But actually, see, I didn't find
I think that was overdone, that particular scene.
Yes.
But actually, the social ineptitude and her lack of understanding of how other people are perceiving her is what makes her very memorable, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm not necessarily.
But it brings up another point, if you like, which is plausibility for me. And it's a very successful book and many people love it. I found a lot of it very implausible, indeed. And so for me, she's not a really a memorable character. So that's interesting. You know, we have to, I have to believe in a character. Yeah. And I know, that's what I'm trying to create.
I think what made her popular was the social ineptitude. So it just goes to show you don't have to create it doesn't have to be plausible for people to love it. You know, that's Hermione Granger in Harry Potter. I quite like her
because she's
clever and sensible and organised, and she kind of gets one over on the boys all the time, which is a bit of a caricature. And some of the other Harry Potter, and I know we're talking about children's books again, but, you know, I do think it doesn't have to be plausible. If it's funny enough or clever enough or whatever.
And
fantasy,
on the genre.
If it's fantasy, they can be whoever they like, can't they?
One of the most memorable characters is in Isaac Asimov's books, Daniil, the robot. You know, he's got the three laws, which I was just trying to look up because I can't remember what they are now I'm talking. But he obeys the rules, but still manages to kind of make mistakes and do things wrong. Mm-hmm. So even a robot,
very human character.
Even a robot can you know, be that human.
Well, I think that Scout and Atticus Finch are...
I chose Atticus.
You mentioned Scout.
Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird is such a memorable character for me. She's an observer, and she brings us to this child's understanding of things, and she's learning so much, and she kind of gives us the gist of the story through her questioning mind, because she doesn't understand everything that's going on, but she knows that there's something important going. But she leads us through that with her inquisitive mind. And of course, because she's a strong character, because she's such a tomboy and so clever, and I think she's just a marvelous character, and I believed everything she did, you know?
I just
love that character.
Yeah.
And Linda said, and Atticus Finch, you know, he was one of my picks for most memorable characters. It's partly because we see him through Scout's eyes.
Yes.
Isn't it? And I think we see both of them. They are, it is we believe, semi-autobiographical.
Yes, yeah. As you were saying, you know, the way she perceived her father as a child, he doesn't do anything but sit in the house and read, you know, so...
Yeah. So I mean, I don't know to what extent almost all my other sort of reading friends would sort of probably name Atticus as one of their sort of favourite and most memorable characters. And I wonder to what extent it's partly based on the fact that it was such a good film and Gregory Peck was so perfect. Mm-hmm. But I think even without that, the sense of the character comes through.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the honourable, the just, the fair.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are things that we aspire to.
Yeah. It's all his great qualities.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That appeal.
One of my favourites is Steerpike from, when I was just, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of books I've read, there were three that sort of stood out, and Steerpike was one of them. And I really wanted him to be an anti-hero. I really wanted him to be a survivor. I wanted him to be a good guy. But he actually turns into quite a villain. And, you know, he was a very complex character for me, and he stood right out. And it was not just, you know, the way he looked, the way he behaved, the way, you know, the fact that he'd been an orphan and he'd had to claw his way up through the castle hierarchy. But he certainly stood out for me. And I'm not sure that it was the guy from Police who played him in the film.
Sting?
Sting, yeah, he played him in the film. Right. Yeah. And I'm not sure he was a good choice, but...
I think as well...
I'm not sure he's ever a good choice.
Well, there are characters who are... fairly one-dimensional, in my opinion. I'm going to float one here. Miss Havisham.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Memorable character.
Yeah.
No rounded bits at all.
No.
She's, you know, she's just somebody that sat in a wedding dress.
Mm. Yeah.
Implausible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Implausible, unlikely. The only thing we know about her is that she got left at the altar. And
that's typical of Dickens, though. Yeah. He does it so well with his
She is a memorable character.
Yes, absolutely.
If you say to anybody, Miss Havisham,
they'll know.
And in fact, you can say, God, I'm going to end up like Miss Havisham. Or, you know, it's almost
Never read a word of Dickens
will know what Miss Havisham is. So she is a memorable character.
Yeah.
Whether she's complex, rounded, interesting.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, that's an interesting point, because as Dickens does that all the time, and in Dombey and Son, there's a character who he characterises as wooden, and he refers to the, you know, but he exaggerates and makes this very complex conceit of
There are lines like, the line I always remember is, Barkis is willing.
Yes, yes.
You know, which again is I don't even know which of the books it's in, you know, but obviously I have read a lot. I think it could have been.
Do you have any others, Heather, apart from the little robot character?
Yes, I wrote three characters down. One was Daniel from Isaac Asimov, Hermes from Anne Zarudi's books, who was a god, and Gandalf from Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And when I looked at all three, it was pointed out to me that, they were, you know, they're all male characters, and they were all sort of not people. You know, one was a magician, one was a robot, and the other one's a god.
Yeah.
But I quite like the fact that...
You like fantasy.
I do like fantasy, but I also quite like the fact that they're not perfect. Because even the god, and I like the fact that Hermes is a god, because I always wondered what happened to them when, you know, you stopped believing in them.
Yeah.
And there he is. But he makes mistakes. He's got human traits. You know, he overeats, and, you know, Gandalf makes mistakes and all of that sort of thing. Yeah. So I quite like the less than perfect.
Yes.
And are you drawn to, like, the magician, you know, as an archetype?
No. I think it's the making mistakes bit.
It's the humanity as so much as the humanness.
Yes, that's right.
It's the humanness.
But the Greek gods aren't well behaved.
No.
Or in any way, are they? They're not. It's not a moral religion.
No, and Hermes is quite greedy, likes his food and his wine.
So
what appeals to you about Gandalf?
Because he's a magician, because he's this, you know, suddenly he's got a ring and all the rest of it, and, you know, all the sort of Middle Earth things that are going on. He still forgets things and, you know, sort of slips up and, you know, ends up isolated. And in a way, he could have been written. Not that J.R. Tolkien's going to listen to me now, but it could have been written as a very perfect kind of magician that was always perfect and good and always got things right.
Powerful,
and I like the fact that he doesn't.
Yeah. So here's a challenge, a female character. Can you come up with one?
Well, the more I thought about it then, I thought of all sorts of characters, but I couldn't think of one that... for me, is particularly memorable. I thought about Rebecca and Jane Eyre and, all of that, which I enjoyed and I liked, but none of them seemed to jump out at me.
Yeah.
What I'm thinking is the fantasy and the science fiction, the books you're talking about, are written by men and they're dominated by a male character.
I think you need to write one with a female protagonist.
The only people I could think of as female characters were written by Terry Pratchett, which is Granny Weatherwax and Nanny Ogg.
They sound very real.
They were, again, they're witches, you know, in books of fantasy. So I struggled to find a female character.
Maybe it's the genre.
Possibly. Yeah.
I think the words memorable and, if you like, compelling are maybe working at odds here, because there are lots of memorable characters that are maybe
repellent.
Yeah.
I think she said believable characters.
Well, it's believable and memorable. So, yeah. Because I started to think about believable characters, I started to think what makes a character believable when you're writing them. And then I started to think about what people, you know, memorable characters that I remembered. Yeah.
But even in fantasy and science fiction, you do believe in that world. Yes. You enter into it, otherwise you wouldn't read the book. Yes. Right. You'd be bored by it.
Once you enter it, you're committed to.
Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just fascinated that I'm drawn to the loner anti-hero, you're drawn to the magician, mage archetypes,
interesting. Yeah.
Feisty female, clever female characters.
Yeah, I'm drawn to feisty females. I know I said Atticus was my sort of first choice, but Jean Brodie.
Oh, yes. My next choice. I love her.
And
also very flawed.
Yes, incredibly flawed.
You obviously didn't think so.
No,
that was a sarcastic response.
She lives in the memory. You know, all my sort of crime fiction heroines, Kay Scarpetta.
D.I. Wachowski that you put me on to.
Mm. Yeah.
She's a very strong female character, isn't she?
Yeah. V.I. Fisher Wachowski. That's the
There's one. A series of books by M.J. Arledge that feature a fairly confident but not particularly likeable and rather flawed female character as well.
Yeah, Scott Patter's a real perfectionist, isn't she? And she could be unlikable, but she somehow manages not to be. I don't know how she does that.
Yeah.
She should be an unlikable character, but somehow she's got enough human flaws that she is likable. So, do we have to like the characters that are memorable for us?
No,
not at all.
Big difference between memorable, believable, likable.
Yeah.
I read The Chestnut Man, which was a horror book. Mm. Horrible book. I don't like horror books, but I was so involved in that I kept turning the pages. And there's no way you can like this character. He's a horrible character, but
memorable.
What, you
mean the detective?
No, the murderer.
Oh, right. We're not supposed to like murderers. But interestingly, you bring that up because he is one of my most, you know, memorable detectives in recent years.
Yeah, well, when you said we're going to talk about writing characters, I just picked up from my bookshelf one of my favourite authors, Nelson Algren, The Man with the Golden Arm. And if I just read you the opening, you get a sense of character. The captain never drank, yet toward nightfall in that smoke-coloured season between Indian summer and December's first true snow, he would sometimes feel half drunken. He would hang his coat neatly over the back of his chair in the leaden station house twilight, save his beak from lack of sleep, and lay his head across his arms upon the query room desk. Yet it wasn't work that wearied him so, and his sleep was harassed by more than a smoke-coloured rain. The city had filled him with the guilt of others. He was numbed by his charge sheet's accusations. For 20 years, upon the same scarred desk he had been recording larceny and arson, sodomy and simony, boosting, hijacking and shootings in sudden affray, blackmail and terrorism, incest and pauperism, embezzlement and horse theft, tampering and procuring, abduction and quackery, adultery and mackery, till the finger of guilt, pointing so sternly for so long across the query room blotter, had grown bored with it all at last and turned capriciously to touch the fibres of the dark grey muscle behind the captain's light grey eyes. So that though by daylight he remained the pursuer, there had come nights this windless first week of December when he had dreamed he was being pursued. Mm. And I think that just conveys a lot of character in two short paragraphs in the opening of the book. Mm-hmm. You know, how troubled he is, how weary he is of it all. Mm. He doesn't drink, but, you know, which sets him slightly apart, well, a lot apart from all the other characters in this book about drug addiction and alcohol. So I just thought that was an example of how to create character.
Yeah, obliquely.
Yes.
So in conclusion then, we think it's a mix of archetypes, characteristics, flaws, humanity, things we can aspire to.
seeing people in relation to other people as well.
Yeah, how they relate to other people. So I don't know if I'm any more well-equipped to write a memorable character, but I feel I can certainly have a go now.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Thanks very much, everybody. It's almost time to end, but before we go, there's just time for Teresa and Claire Hanscom to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Teresa, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I've just finished reading Ghost by Robert Harris, which I thoroughly enjoyed. In terms of believable characters, I love the narrative voice. So the person telling the story is a ghostwriter, a bit of a hack, and he's quite a cold character. You know, when his girlfriend walks out, he's kind of like, so what? So he's not immediately appealing. But although he's, you know, cynical in some ways, he gets drafted in to write the memoirs of a former British Prime Minister when the guy who was originally doing it dies in very ambiguous circumstances. And so he is politically naive. He knows nothing about politics. So he's both a naive and a cynical character, if you like. The person he's writing this memoir, ghostwriting for, is a very thinly veiled portrait of Tony Blair. And I think that is brilliantly done. Both Tony and Sherry Blair are brilliantly portrayed, and I think obviously he doesn't use their names, but and obviously the story is at least partly fiction. There is a twist in the tale at the end. It is a thriller, and it does keep you, I read it over a couple of days quite quickly, and what I love about Robert Harris is his writing is really accessible. He makes it seem effortless. It's obviously not. It's obviously thoroughly researched and everything, but his work is serious but accessible.
Very good. Thank you very much. And Claire?
So I'm just finishing a book called Don't You Forget About Me by Vary McFarlane, who's a romantic comedy author. I read a book of hers a while ago called You Had Me at Hello, which I really loved. And this one that I'm reading now was offered to me by her publicist to potentially have her on my podcast. Haven't nailed down a date. Don't know if I'm actually going to get to do that, but I've enjoyed the book. It's about a young woman who ends up meeting up with a guy that she knew at secondary school and actually was her first love. And she starts working for him and he doesn't seem to remember her. I haven't finished it yet, so I don't know how it ends, although I mean, it's a romantic comedy. But I'm really enjoying it. It is funny, but it's also quite touching, and she's dealing with grief and dealing with various family issues and also trying to find herself and figure out her own, what she really wants in life and things like that. So yeah, it's a really good read and I'm enjoying that.
Thanks very much, Claire. That was great. Thank you for joining us once again. I'd like to ask you to subscribe to iTunes or Stitcher so that every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. Come along and join our Facebook group. Just search for Write Club the Podcast on Facebook. Leave a review. That is the one thing that will help us grow. And if you enjoy the show, please take the time to leave a review. And tell a friend about Write Club. Just telling one person a week would make us grow fast. We'll be back again next week at the same time for another episode of Write Club the Podcast. Thanks very much, everybody.
Bye.